This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Well, fairy tales are as popular as ever. In 2015, Disney released their big budget live action Cinderella. This year, Beauty and the Beast. Tangled, the animation based on Rapunzel, was a big hit for them in 2010. With new tellings of traditional fairy tales still hitting the box office, I thought it would be fun to dig a little deeper into some of the origins of these fairy tales. Kate Forsyth is an international fantasy and historical fiction author who's published around 40 books, and she's also a fairy tale expert with a doctorate of creative arts in fairy tale studies. Who knew there was such a thing? Kate, welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming in. How did you develop your fascination with fairy tales?
Oh, well, I was just a little girl who I was quite sick as a child, spent a long time in hospital, and my mother gave me a copy of Grimm's Fairy Tales when I was about 7 years old. And, you know, I was kind of confined to a hospital bed, and so I could only have adventures in my imagination. And so these wonderful stories of magic and adventure and escape and, you know, battles between good and evil, they just fed my imagination at a time when I really, really needed them. And as I grew older and I began to study the history and the meaning of fairy tales, that just deepened my fascination with them.
I can imagine if you're trapped in a hospital bed and you hear a story like Rapunzel locked in a tower, there'd be some resonance there, wouldn't there?
Yeah, I really think that's so true. I only realised this as an adult when I began to kind of try and understand my own fascination with it. As a child, I just loved the stories and I loved the feeling that they gave me, and I loved that kind of delicious shiver at some of the darkness and some of the scary aspects of the fairy tales. I loved that aspect of the fairy tales. But as an adult, looking back, I go, oh, now I understand. You know, they gave me something that I needed at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a favourite?
Well, people ask me that all the time, and I generally say that Rapunzel is my favourite because of that whole kind of linkage, you know, the girl in a tower, locked up against her will, lonely and afraid. I was a little girl locked up in a hospital ward against my will, lonely and afraid. And the other thing that's really interesting about Rapunzel is that she not only escapes her tower, but she actually has this kind of magical healing power. And so she finds the prince who had, you know, been blinded when he fell from the tower height, and she weeps and her tears fall upon his eyes and heal him. Well, I was in hospital because I was attacked by a dog when I was just a toddler, and I actually had my tear duct destroyed. So I had no ability to control my tears, and my lack of a tear duct was actually a life-threatening condition for me. So my tears made me ill. Rapunzel's tears healed. And so there was this kind of great subconscious kind of potency about that. And I think that that is why it haunted my imagination.
That's so remarkable, isn't it? Those links. Well, let's move on to Beauty and the Beast, because that's the one at the movies at the moment. It's one of the oldest fairy tales in existence, isn't it? What are the origins of the story?
Well, Beauty and the Beast, the actual fairy tale, was a literary fairy tale. And so it was written by a woman, a French noblewoman, in the 1740s. But the storyline, the idea of this girl being married to or being held prisoner by a beast, is actually linked all the way back to Cupid and Psyche, which was a story written in about the 2nd century AD, so 2,000 years ago.
Wow.
It was written by a guy called Apuleius and published in a book called Metamorphosis, which most people have heard of. It's a famous, famous book, one of the very first novels ever written 2,000 years ago. And Cupid and Psyche is a story about a young woman who is married to what she thinks is a monster, a serpent, but is in fact the god Cupid. And she betrays him unwittingly by trying to find out who he is, and she has to go through a series of trials and tribulations, including going down into the underworld and then returning to life. And so it's a story about a young woman who has to learn to look below the surface and find the truth, not to trust what her eyes tell her, not to trust the surfaces of things, but to look more deeply. And it's about her journey towards wisdom.
Think that that is the essence of the story that we still have today?
Yes, I absolutely do think so. Okay. You know, the a French noblewoman who wrote the story. Her name was Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve.
I'll never be able to repeat that. So.
I wish I could do it with a much better French accent. The French fairy tale tellers all have the most amazing names.
Yeah.
So Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve, she was a highly educated French noblewoman. She would have been familiar with Metamorphoses and with Cupid and Psyche, which is one of the most popular stories, you know, from the Greek, ancient Greece. I think, you know, for her, her story was a very big one. It was very long. It was 100 pages long.
Was it intended for children, Kate?
No, it was very sexy.
Okay, wow.
And the beast in the story was very wild, very fierce, and the girl had to tame him. She had to bring him back to being human again.
Okay.
Now, about 16 years later, another French noblewoman, whose name, wait for it, Jeanne-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont.
I'll call her Bowie, yeah.
Yeah, Bowie. She retold the story for adolescent girls, and so she cut it back from the novel length to a story that was published in a magazine for schoolgirls.
Okay, so she took out the sexy bit of it.
She took out all the sexy bits, and she made the hero much more, he was still a man, even though he was clad in this kind of terrible fur coat. He was still a man within, and it was as much a journey of the girls to learn to appreciate him as it was of him to come back. And so it was much more like the story that we have nowadays. The story of Beauty and the Beast now is a story of both hero and heroine having to learn to look beneath the surface, having to learn how to love and how to trust. And that, I think, is part of the beauty.
Yeah, that's a wonderful message, isn't it? So what's the most important symbol in the Beauty and the Beast tale?
Well, there's a number of different symbols that are famous. There is, of course, the rose. Now, the rose is one of those kind of human symbols that's laden with meaning. For example, you know, they used to hang a rose above a secret meeting. It was called sub rosa. And so anything that was said in that cone of silence under the rose was secret and could not be repeated. The rose has long been a symbol of passion, but it's also a symbol of the pain of life, the thorns, the possibility of sin and desire married with that romantic ideal of love. So a rose always has thorns.
Yes.
And it simply means that you know, love can cause pain.
And you do see it in that story, don't you?
You do. That's right. It's not an easy romance at all. Both hero and heroine have a long way to travel before they actually are rewarded with true love.
True love, the ultimate prize.
Yes.
That's Beauty and the Beast that we've been talking about. What about Sleeping Beauty? Because it's a popular children's story now as well, but its origins are a little darker. How's that story changed over time?
Well, I've actually spent the last year or two working on Sleeping Beauty because I'm writing a Sleeping Beauty retelling at the moment. And I have to say it is probably the most problematic of all fairy tales because of the fact that the heroine is asleep. You know, she's extremely vulnerable. She's extremely passive. There's no sense of her as being an active heroine, you know, fighting and learning and growing as there is in Beauty and Beast. It is also a very, very old tale, not nearly as old as Beauty and Beast. The first Sleeping Beauty tales, you know, were really 12th or 13th century, and they were in the French tradition of courtly love. The earliest one that was ever written down, because just remember that all fairy tales have their roots in oral storytelling traditions. Sleeping Beauty was first written down in about, you know, the 1300s as a story called Troilus and Zelandine.
Ooh,
and Zelandine is a girl who is cursed to sleep, and she's actually left alone in a ruined castle, naked, for years and years and years, asleep. And Troilus is a prince who just happened to be, you know, riding past, stumbles across this castle, stumbles upon this sleeping girl. Well, what you really need to know is that Troilus and Zelandine is definitely not for children.
Okay, all right. We won't go into the details of what happens there then.
We won't go into the details.
It's not too hard to guess, yes.
Yes, but what you do need to know is that Zelandine is impregnated with twins, and she's actually woken up after she gives birth to her children, a little boy and a little girl, and the little boy suckles on her finger and pulls out the flax splinter, which is the you know, like the splinter or the prick.
Sleeping Beauty, yeah.
From Sleeping Beauty that put her to sleep. And so this poor girl has been asleep for a long, long time in this ruined castle, wakes up, unmarried mother of twins. Oh, no dear. Father to be found.
That's not a kind story to her, is it?
No. And this pattern of Sleeping Beauty actually continued in all the retellings all the way up to Charles Perrault, who was famous for the Beauty in the Sleeping Wood. And he changed it so there are no babies and there's no sense of any violence or anything else in the story. It becomes a much more romantic story.
Much more palatable story too, yeah.
Exactly. This is what we see with fairy tales, is that the original versions are often much darker, much more violent, much more cruel, and often much, much funnier as well.
Okay, yeah.
Because in many of the kind of storytelling traditions, the violence in the fairy tales is a little bit like what we see in cartoons nowadays. It's meant to make you laugh. And it's meant to make you, give you a little shock and then make you laugh.
Yeah, well, I guess it was a much more violent time. People didn't live long. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
It was a far more violent time. And in actual fact, like a young boy in those days would have been trained in the arts of war as a matter of course if they were of noble blood. It was expected that they would go and fight and kill people. Well, now we don't send our eight-year-old boys off to learn how to shoot bows and arrows and fight with the expectation they're going to use those skills.
So a very different time.
It's a different time.
We know that Perrault, you said, rewrote it and made it sort of, I suppose, a bit more like the story that we know now.
Yes.
And what's your take on the meaning or the symbolism in the modern Sleeping Beauty story?
Well, Sleeping Beauty, I think, like many, many fairy tales, actually has its roots in ancient myths.
Okay.
And so if you think about the story of Persephone and Demeter, I don't know how well you know your Greek myths, but Persephone was the daughter of a goddess and she had to go down into the world of death, into the underground, and she ate a few little seeds of pomegranates. I think she ate 6 seeds. And so because of that, she was condemned to spend 6 months of every year in winter. And when she was in the underworld, the whole world grieved. Her mother grieved. You know, she was a goddess of summer and harvest. And so we had the 6 months of winter. And then when Persephone returns to life, we have spring and summer, and we have the return of life to the whole world. And Sleeping Beauty has its roots in those kind of ancient stories of life, death, rebirth. The kiss of love that wakens her, when she awakens, the whole world awakens too. And so the whole world is returned to sunshine and to life and to fertility.
Okay, so it's sort of a metaphor for death and new life.
Yeah, it is, but it's got a lot to do. Like most fairy tales, they often tell stories about young women who are growing up. And so it's a story of, you know, sensual awakening, of her, you know, coming, you know, going from a girl into a woman. And that is a really important part of most fairy tales, because most of them were told by women to women. As they spun and wove and sewed and did the work, they would tell each other stories to help the work go faster. And so most fairy tales are actually stories of female empowerment.
And that's interesting, isn't it? So it's nothing to do with kids. They're women sharing stories for women to help them understand their place in the world and their role as becoming women.
Fairy tales did not begin to be aimed for a childish market until the Victorians. And so in the mid-1800s, about 1850, 1860, a group of people in England began to translate the Grimm brothers from German into English. And they rewrote them and they took out all the sexual innuendo, they took out a lot of the darkness, they sweetened them and they made them much more palatable.
And that's what we're left with now.
And then, of course, Disney has continued this. Each major wave of fairy tale retelling has seen the stories reduced down, made for a younger audience and made much more whimsical and charming and sweet and free of some of those darkness and violence of the older stories.
Yeah. What about Rapunzel. I mean, that's eternally popular, and it was recreated as Tangled. Mm-hmm. Lots of singing and dancing and lightness. You actually studied this one for your doctorate of creative arts, didn't you?
I did. I have a doctorate in Rapunzel.
Yeah, that's amazing. So when did this story become really popular and well-known?
Well, again, it's a very, very old story. If we look at the kind of Maiden in the Tower tale, we're going back to Greek myth and the story of Danae, and who was locked up in a brass tower by her father. It appears in Islamic traditions, in Jewish traditions. It appears all over the world. It is one of the world's most pervasive fairy tales.
What's it really about?
The tower stands in as a symbol of all things that tie us back from growth. In modern day, we could say that our tower could be an unhappy marriage. Mm. It could be a job that we hate, that sickens us to have to go and do that every single day, but we feel trapped in a situation. It could be being trapped physically, but normally it's more about spiritual entrapment or emotional entrapment. All fairy tales actually work in what I call, you know, the language of the night. Metaphor, symbol, archetype. And so the girl locked in a tower is a symbol for anyone who's locked anywhere that they don't want to be.
So it's about not being able to achieve your heart's desire?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. What it's about. Now, what you've got to realize with these fairy tales is it's not so important that she's locked up as that she escapes.
Mm.
And so once again, just like Psyche and just like the Sleeping Beauty, she stands in for the human spirit. And so it's a story of someone who finds themselves in a state of stasis, unable to move forward, unable to escape, and then they find within themselves the strength to break out of that and to go on and grow. She's locked away when she's a maiden. By the end of the story, she's a mother with twins. It's another story of an unwed teenage mother.
Yeah, wow. Which is a common occurrence all throughout the history of time, isn't it?
Exactly.
But what about the hair? How do you explain? So she's got, is it always magical? Is that a new addition, having the magical hair?
The first time that the hair was mentioned in the story was actually in the Islamic version of the story, which is a beautiful story called Rubidah and Zell. Mm. And the girl has long black hair. And she's locked away in a harem, and she lowers her hair to allow the hero to climb up and be with her in the harem. The next morning, her father finds them, and then he forgives her because, you know, she is in love. So it's a quite different story. There's none of that sense of the witch and the cutting of the hair. But from that point on, hair appeared in every single version around the world.
Mm.
So it's quite interesting how we study the history of fairy tales and how they move is when motifs are added and when motifs are lost. And so once the motif of the hair was in there, it was in all of the stories.
Mm.
So this is, again, about 2,000 years ago.
What's the magical hair represent?
Well, hair has always been a symbol of life, of strength, and of sexuality. You only need to think about Samson and Delilah.
Mm.
You know, when she chops off his hair,
his power goes.
His power goes. The hair is thought to keep on growing after we are dead. And so it's also seen as being a symbol of resurrection. And when we look at a story like Rapunzel, her incarceration within that tower is like a symbolic death or a symbolic wounding. And the cutting of the hair is like the cutting of the umbilical cord.
Mm.
And it allows her to be born again as a woman, free and her own personal agent.
She's always dependent on the prince, though, as well, isn't she, or the guy?
No, see, that's a big misunderstanding about Rapunzel. It's a thing that people say to me all the time, but isn't it all about a passive princess?
Being rescued by him.
Twirling her hair, being rescued by the prince. And I'm going, well, first off, she was never a princess. Her parents were so desperately poor that they stole a handful of Rapunzel leaves or parsley leaves from a witch. They were desperately poor.
Mm-hmm.
She was never a princess.
Okay.
She's locked up in the tower against her will, but then she sings, and it's with the power of her voice that she draws the prince to her. She's actually an active agent.
So she's using what she has at her disposal,
which is her voice. Exactly.
Yeah.
The prince rises, you know, climbs up the hair. They fall in love. They fall into bed. And then the witch finds out that Rapunzel has been visited by her lover in the tower, and she casts Rapunzel out into the wilderness. And then when the prince comes, he climbs up the hare, and then the witch says to him, "You think to find your pretty bird, but she has flown, and now I shall scratch out your eyes."
Oh, terrifying.
And she flings, I know, and she flings him down from the tower height, and he's wounded. He is blinded. And in darkness, unable to find his way, he wanders for a long time in the wilderness. And then Rapunzel sings and draws him towards her. And then when she finds him, she weeps and heals him. So it is Rapunzel that rescues the prince.
Not the prince.
The prince does not much at all.
So it is a story about female empowerment,
it
then.
It is. It's one of the most misunderstood fairy tales of them all. Mm. And as you can tell, I quite like disabusing people of that particular misconception.
I can see that you're quite passionate about this. So lots of powerful symbols in that story. We've got the hare, yeah. We've got the tower.
We've got the wounding of both, you know, the maiden and the prince, this kind of, you know, symbolic wounding, this symbolic death and rebirth. It's a story about resurrection. Mm. It's incredibly powerful. And in the most commonly known version, which was written by a woman called Charlotte Rose de Caumont de la Force, another French woman, she actually rescues the witch as well. Mm. And so at the end of her story, the witch is drawn to repent of her cruelty to the young lovers, and she is saved because of her repentance.
Yeah, it's a redemptive story then.
It's a redemptive story.
Yeah, but that's been lost as well.
Yeah, the Grimm brothers just left that little bit off. Mm. So they ended the story with the prince and the princess, or the, you know, the prince and Rapunzel finding each other and being married with their two little girls. I think it's a boy and a girl. And they left off the redemption of the witch. And I've often wondered why the Grimm brothers were the ones that brought in a lot of the darker elements against mothers and against stepmothers. You know, the dancing in hot red shoes at the end of Snow White, for example, was a detail added by the Grimm brothers. I've always thought how psychologically interesting that is.
Mm, so maybe they don't like mums and stepmums.
Well, they adored their mother, but she was a very, very strong and dominant woman.
Okay. Mm, they might say something about it then,
yeah,
possibly.
Well,
there's so much in it, isn't there, that we will never know. But so the key moral lesson from Rapunzel then?
The key lesson, because all fairy tales have a lesson, the key lesson is if you are held in stasis, if you are entrapped within a tower against your will, whatever your tower may be, if you have strength enough and if you have courage enough, you can escape. You can be the instrument of your own salvation.
Mm. That's a very powerful message.
It is. Mm. That's why I love it so much.
Oh, thanks, Kate.
That's
it's been
pleasure.
Inspiring. That's international author Kate Forsyth. We've been speaking on the origins of some of the best-loved fairy tales. You can also find more info at her website.